You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with award-winning author Intan Paramedita. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
So I'm going to read the first two pages of the novel. Prologue, Demon Lover. Beware the gifts you accept, or so said your elders. But it's too late. You ask for the package, a present that comes with a curse. Demon Lover has granted you a pair of red shoes. Demon Lover arrives as you are desperately contemplating flight. The Wandering is a choose-your-own-adventure novel, and the reader is situated in the shoes of this brown woman from the Global South, this Indonesian woman. She's 27, and she is, in a way, she's stuck with her life. She aspires to be middle class, but her job doesn't allow her to achieve sort of social mobility. She can't even go abroad. So in her condition, she makes a deal with the devil. So this is sort of a reference to the story of Faust and Mephistopheles. You exchange something to get something. So this woman finally gets a pair of red shoes that will take her anywhere. But that means that she will never be able to find home. That's the curse of the shoes. This is a sort of a fantastic story, but it's also, I would say, a reflective question around the politics and the privileges of travel. The title is Gentayangan. Gentayangan means wandering, but it also means haunting. It's a word that we use to describe ghosts who exist in a liminal state. This is a metaphor for people who travel. I was a PhD student in New York. And then I went back to Jakarta to do some preliminary research for my thesis. And it was a really strange experience going back because, yes, you miss home, but you kind of feel that you're not being at home. You kind of want to go back, but I felt that New York wasn't completely my home either. So there's the feeling of being neither here nor there. And I thought that these are the experiences of people who travel, other international students, maybe migrant workers, refugees. I wanted to capture the sense of being everywhere, which is kind of liberating, but also the sense of displacement as a brown woman growing up, thinking that only rich people can travel. I think this identity, it sort of drove me to ask questions. Who can travel? Who can cross boundaries? How our experiences are different depending on where we come from, depending on our passports, our gender, class, and race. There are 15 different endings. And it's really interesting how when I made the choices, I didn't have this idea that if you are this kind of person, then you would pick A or you would pick B. But some readers who read The Wandering, they told me that, oh, maybe I'm a good girl. So I tend to make safe choices. I also wanted to play with this idea of the road not taken, because if you choose one path, you won't be able to see another path, or you'll be able to see glimpses of the other path and you feel like, oh, that path seems to be more exciting than this path. I grew up with folktales and fairy tales, like other kids, I guess, from the Indonesian archipelago, from the Nusantara. I grew up with the stories from the Grimm brothers and Hans Christian Andersen. And these fairy tales are very dark. And actually, I like them better than the Disney version because they're more bloody and gory. I guess that also shaped my preferences for more dark and gothic stories as I grew up. So I grew up with English literature because I did English literature at the University of Indonesia. I wrote a BA thesis on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. My mother was a very imaginative person. She would tell me bedtime stories. Sometimes she would read, but I think she loved making her own stories. So I think I inherit that from her, just the desire to create your own story. But she wasn't a writer. She never had the chance to explore her creative side. I think there were certain expectations for women at that time, you know, to get married. Mothers can be terrifying. So we tend to be to think in the binary between good mothers and bad mothers. And then I guess because I learned from my mother, I finally realized that, oh, yes, I know why my mother acted strange. I know why I considered her monstrous when she was younger. She was trying to sort of reject society's expectations in her own way, but we didn't understand her, and therefore we labeled her as monsters. And so I became really interested in the so-called bad women or monstrous women in a way that these women allow me to ask questions around the structures that create them. Part of the work that I do now is to work with a feminist collective to actually question knowledge production and who is excluded from it, who is being marginalized because of it. And I guess my mother played a great role in steering me to that direction, not just my mother, but also the generations of women before me. It's really important to think about our influences in ways that are more political, more critical, and more feminist. And if you have a certain group of writers that you admire when you are 19, it doesn't mean that it's fixed. You need to transcend the list of writers. I'm always interested in witches, that I was obsessed with Gothic women writers, Mary Shelley, Margaret Atwood, Angela Carter. But when I was in my 20s, these were all white women writers. I think because of the limitation of my knowledge at that time, I didn't really include more writers of color. I didn't even know that there was this Indonesian author, Marianne Katopo. I had read her novel before, but I didn't know that she produced a feminist theology book where she questioned Christianity in a feminist way and an anti-colonial way. But the more I read, the more that I can expand my list of literary influences. We always need to question the authors that we read, especially in the Anglophone world, because not all great writings have been translated into English, or even if they've been translated into English, perhaps they're not available widely. One woman writer, she was affiliated with the leftist movement. Her name is Siti Rukia. So she wrote very interesting stories that always highlight the condition of poor women. So it's always intersectional. It would be poor women who are old. So age is part of it, being poor is part of it, and gender is part of it. But her writings were banned in 1965 when the Suharto regime took over, and then we had the crushing of the feminist movement along with the massacre of people accused to be communist. So we never heard of her in our class. In my stories, I incorporate a lot of Islamic elements, and I think it's really important to tell Islamic stories from Southeast Asia. The more I travel, the more I identify myself as culturally Muslim, perhaps because I see that Islamophobia is real. This is the religion that is still viewed through a colonial lens as the religion of the other. And therefore, it's important to provide different narratives about this religion that are critical of the religion itself, but at the same time, provide sort of a counter narrative to the dominant colonial Western narrative. I've been playing with AI just to see what it can do. People who are not privileged with skills to conceptualize it, skills of abstract thinking, they will be replaced. And I'm just thinking about people from the Global South. At this moment, people from the Global South, they do a lot of support for creative work of entrepreneurs in the Global North. They do social media. They create content. The people who would provide this support live in, let's say, the Philippines. What I'm worried about is how AIs could take the jobs of people who are not really trained to do conceptual thinking. There are forms of tribal writing that highlight environmental destruction. Some tribal writers have shared a sense of responsibility in creating narratives around tribal in relation to the climate crisis. So this is good. But at the same time, I think we also need to first raise critical awareness around the media productions that glamorize tribal, that eventually result in tribal practices that are quite irresponsible, very individualistic and very inconsiderate in terms of environmental destruction. We question the impact of cheap flight, but we also need to question how wealthy countries take advantage of cheap labor outside those countries, or they relocate production and emission in the global south, and then they blame people in the global south for being the contributors of the climate crisis. Whenever I encounter beauty, it's immediately disrupted. For instance, whenever I go to Bali and then looking at how beautiful the sunset is, and then I went back to the city after going to the beach and looking at the sunset, I'm reminded of how Bali becomes Bali because of the structures of global inequalities that make tourism possible. It's always disrupted, but maybe it's important to appreciate the beauty of nature around you, but then be constantly disrupted by all these thoughts and questions. It's important to imagine, to keep imagining a world that is free from colonialism, from oppression, from exploitation, also expropriation of nature. And unfortunately, this world is not here. We are not living in that kind of world today. But if we want to see the world for our next generation, for the future, we need to pass the torch and ask them to imagine. And then perhaps that way the struggle will continue.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.